Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's show is being brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, believers in good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting live from Roberta's on Heritage Radio Network. The renegotiation of the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada began on August 16th of this year. And since then, I've been wondering what's at stake for food, farmers, and the land. Joining me today to unpack the effects NAFTA has on our food system over the past 20 years, and the impact that renegotiating the agreement would have, is Ben Lilliston. Ben's the Director of Corporate Strategies and Climate Change at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, which works locally and globally at the intersection of policy and practice to ensure fair and sustainable food, farm, and trade systems. He's been working and writing about international trade issues and how they intersect with U.S. agricultural policy since 2000, including multiple World Trade Organization ministerials, the passage of CAFTA, several farm bills, and now the current trade debates. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Okay, so let's start at the very beginning. I personally don't know a whole lot about this particular topic, so let's start with the basics. When was this agreement officially enacted, and why?
Yeah, so it was officially enacted and came into being in 1994, and it's good to think about NAFTA. I think it's useful to think about NAFTA in the context of three big things that happened right at that time in the mid-90s. NAFTA came into effect in 1994. The U.S. joined the World Trade Organization, which is the international body that sort of sets the bar for trade of over 160 different countries. And then the 1996 Farm Bill came right after that. And those three things put together really accelerated a trend in U.S. agriculture and food towards more of a global system where we enter into a global market. Farmers are farming and selling into a global system, and agribusiness companies that operate in multiple countries were able to take advantage of those three things at the same time. NAFTA was the first free trade agreement regional free trade agreement that the U.S. had sort of led with just a few countries. And it was the first free trade agreement with a country that had much less economic power than the United States. So Mexico was involved. This is a country that was really struggling with poverty. And the hope was that by entering NAFTA, we would lift up the economic system in Mexico, and they would become a really big market for the United States, and the same for Canada. But that didn't turn out quite that way, and there have been a number of problems associated with NAFTA since then that we can go into when you want to.
So the idea is that we would sort of bolster their economies, and they would basically import more U.S. products. That was the thinking?
Yeah, that they would lift their standard of living, and that, you know, even back then, at that time, immigration was an issue, and so the idea is that we'll spur their economic growth. People will not have to come across the border to find work, and there'll be more disposable income to purchase U.S. products. Now, what actually happened was when you have a country as powerful as the U.S. is, particularly from an economic standpoint, we basically overwhelmed Mexico after NAFTA. And what NAFTA did was it did several different things, but probably the core thing it did was lower tariffs. And tariffs are taxes that when you trade something and cross a border, one of the countries will charge a tax for you to enter into that country. Mm-hmm. And NAFTA basically gradually eliminated those tariffs when it comes to agriculture and food products. And so Mexico no longer had the ability to protect their farmers from really cheap U.S. imports. And so a flood of U.S. Exports went into Mexico, many of them really cheap and in some cases below the cost of production. And in particular, our corn exports really affected Mexico's economy. And by most estimates, they pushed off around 2 million Mexican farmers.
Wow.
They couldn't survive. And many of those people in the rural countryside in Mexico then ended up migrating to the U.S. So that we actually, instead of slowing immigration, it actually sped it up.
Huh.
And we had a large increase in Mexicans coming across the border to find work, and the irony is many of the places that they found work were within the U.S. agricultural system, whether it was working in fruit and vegetable farms or meat processing plants,
right,
or dairy operations.
So what? First of all, what are our percentage of our food in the United States, generally speaking, is imported, and in roughly what categories?
Well, you know, that's a difficult question to answer, partly because it depends on the different sectors that you're looking at, and in some cases, it's even more complicated than that. So, and this is partly the legacy of NAFTA. So prior to NAFTA, the U.S. was a net fruit and vegetable exporter. In other words, we exported more than we imported.
Mm-hmm.
But after NAFTA, many of the fruit and vegetable companies saw the opportunities to move down to Mexico and see cheaper labor, but as well as longer growing season, so set up the operation. So now we're a net, we import much more than we used to in terms of our fruit and vegetable consumption.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of meat, and this is where it gets complicated, the U.S. regularly imports a large number of cattle, sort of young cattle, that have been born in Mexico. They come over to the United States, they get fattened up and processed here, and then often they may get exported back down to Mexico.
Huh,
but the same thing happens. We also import a lot of really young Canadian cattle as well. And then we also import a lot of really young feeder pigs, so small baby pigs from Canada, and then finish them off here. And so it's a really a North American system of food and agriculture that we've set up here as a result of NAFTA. Over time, you know, NAFTA was not the first, was the first of these kind of free trade agreements, but there have been ensuing ones, and so that system has grown probably a little larger even to Central America now with the Central American Free Trade Agreement, which came into being about 5 or 10 years after NAFTA.
So it's tricky to say kind of what, you know, in the different categories, especially it seems like with the end, you know, how you define imports, I guess, or exports in terms of where the final product ends up. But like I think I read somewhere that 50% of our organic fruit and vegetables, for instance, is imported into this country, you know, overall, not just from these two countries that are in the trade agreement. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, that sounds right. course, you know, we have other free trade agreements with Peru, Chile, so some of the South American countries, and as I mentioned, some of the Central American countries. So a lot of fruits and vegetables are being imported there, whether they're organic or non-organic. And it also depends on different times of the year. You know, California still does produce a lot of fruit and vegetables for much of the year, but not all the year. In Florida as well.
And what is the most common product, kind of shifting back to NAFTA, that is imported from Mexico? Sure. I think of, like, tomatoes and berries. Is that, you know, is that, like, within the top five, you would say? Or are there other kind of products that we wouldn't think about normally?
Well, tomatoes is definitely a big one. And that has been somewhat controversial. A lot of U.S. producers, particularly in Florida, where they are more seasonal producers of tomatoes, have raised a lot of issues under NAFTA, that they feel like they're getting undercut by Mexican tomatoes, and that the government in Mexico is sort of supporting that. And so they've challenged that under NAFTA rules. Avocados is another big one that people talk a lot about. You know, there's just been many of your listeners, or some, may remember when avocados were not so prevalent in every restaurant and every grocery store. And that's been a big increase, and a lot of that is coming from Mexico.
And then what about Canada? I feel like I don't hear very much about produce or products kind of coming from Canada. So what are the top imports that we're getting from that country?
Right. Well, you know, as I mentioned, even though the cattle have traveled across the borders, we also import beef from cattle from Canada, but also a lot of apples and some of the fruits where they're able to grow on the sort of western part of Canada. Those are the big, you know, we're not getting. Those are the big imports from Canada.
And is there a requirement to label these products as being, you know, what does the labeling scheme look like around imports?
Yeah, good question. That's been a big source of controversy. So for fruits and vegetables, most of those are labeled. Those are, the U.S. has rules around labeling about what country they're coming from. But they don't have it for beef and pork, and that's part of, goes back to what I was describing, is the animal sort of moving across borders throughout its lifetime. The U.S. did have mandatory labeling for that, called country of origin labeling, and that was struck down. Canada and Mexico challenged that law at the World Trade Organization, and they won.
Wow.
And they have a whole dispute settlement process at the WTO. And they won that legal case, and so the U.S. Congress decided to remove that requirement. So for beef and pork, there's no labeling for where, what country they're coming from.
So we don't know where our meat is. Limited transparency.
It's very limited transparency. I mean, a company may decide to label it if they want to, but it's not required.
Wow. That is, why did they challenge that? Was the thought that they, you know, there would increase demand for products if they weren't labeled as being from Canada or Mexico? Because it sounds like,
They believe that if it was labeled as coming from Mexico, that U.S. consumers would be less likely to buy it.
And have we seen, I don't know, maybe it's too soon to tell, but when does the repeal go into place, or when do these labeling schemes? I know we're a little bit off topic talking about COOL versus NAFTA, but is it too soon to see an effect of this?
Oh no, it's already in effect. Yeah, for beef, and as I mentioned, beef and pork, it's already in effect.
So, do we know if it's working for these other countries? Increasing demand, that is.
Oh. So can you ask that question again?
Oh, yeah. So has there been an opportunity to look at whether or not demand has increased, or that it's been like an overall positive effect for Canada and Mexico with the removing of the labeling requirement?
Oh, I see. I have not seen that or heard that. I think it, from their perspective, it was as much about damage control, like trying not to make things worse.
Yeah.
From their perspective. And, you know, part of that debate was that, you know, it's how do you label an animal that was born in Mexico and processed in the United States? And is that a Mexican cattle or American and yeah. or U.S.? And there was a lot of work being done on that to label where an animal was born, where it was raised, and where it was processed. And the U.S. rule was you had to list those three things.
Okay.
And that's what the was struck down as still somehow being prejudicial against the other countries. One of the concepts of the WTO is that at the World Trade Organization, as well as under NAFTA, is that where a product is produced shouldn't matter. That's not something under the trade rules. That's sort of what's viewed as a barrier to trade, and that consumers shouldn't worry about that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Seems to sort of fly in the face of increased, you know, more demand for transparency. That I do think, you know, there's a lot of consumer demand for more transparency in our food system. So that
Definitely.
Seems very yep. contradictory, but okay, to what's kind of what, you know, what's going on right now. What are some kinds of, since there is no labeling requirement right now for the you know, beef and pork, like we discussed, what are the food safety and quality control measures that are currently in place, and who, you know, regulates this? And this is for, you know, all kind of ag products crossing borders through in NAFTA.
Uh-huh. So NAFTA, one of the things that it did was it basically established a food safety chapter, and under that chapter, it said that Mexico and Canada and the U.S. had to be operating under similar food safety rules and laws. It wouldn't have to be exactly the same, but that the effect would be the same. And so the idea was that if you're a company and you're operating in either of those three countries, you would be operating essentially under the same rules and make it easier for companies to set up shop in multiple countries and not have to worry about different regulations.
Mm-hmm.
So what that did was really make it easier for food companies to set up shop in different places, and they have. And they've really, this is part of what we've seen is this consolidation in U.S. food and agriculture, where fewer and fewer companies control more and more of the food supply. And NAFTA helped accelerate that trend that was already happening. And food safety is one of the ways they do that. U.S. has, you know, we have the food, U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA,
mm-hmm.
which regulates some products. And then the USDA also has its own food inspection system, which regulates others, including imports. But the idea is that NAFTA is setting up a common set of rules, and then the U.S. sort of used that chapter in ensuing free trade agreements to set up the same kind of system to basically accelerate imports from other countries.
Right. That makes sense that it's all streamlined. And the USDA oversees that even for other, you know, other, like even for beef, where doesn't that typically fall within FDA's purview? I could be wrong on that.
Yeah. As I understand that, the FDA largely covers fruit and vegetables, and the USDA is more in the animal side of things.
Hmm. Okay. So the USDA oversees everything with the trade agreements in terms of food safety.
Well, not everything. Like I said, the FDA is also involved,
okay.
particularly in fruit and vegetables. And what they're looking at is, and they also now get involved in other countries, so they may go and inspect the facilities of major importers, and they then become an approved importer.
Okay. Okay. All right. So we are going to take a really quick commercial break to hear a word from our sponsors. But when we get back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the effects that NAFTA has had discuss the status of the renegotiation process and what it's going to mean for our food system. Stay tuned.
I'm Michael Harlan Turkell, host of The Food Scene and Modernist Breadcrumbs on Heritage Radio Network. I'm here at Bob's Red Mill to find out from Bob himself why his products taste so good. So what's the secret, Bob?
To make the best whole grain flour, we look back in time. No modern technology can match the old world engineering of a stone mill.
Wow. Bob's Red Mill is using stone mills? How old are we talking here?
Well, the stone mills are practically as old as mankind, and no matter what civilization they uncover, they find two stones that people were rubbing together to make something they could eat, whole wheat flour. But the stones that we use are quarried near Paris, France, in La Ferté, and it's the same stone material from the same quarry that the Romans used to make stone mills all over the Roman Empire, of which you can testify by looking at Pompeii. It's a quartz material. It has a uniqueness about it. It's very hard. It has a certain porosity, and they put the stones together in a unit of 20 pieces and band it so that they use only the best and sharpest parts. It's an ingenious thing, but very old. I mean, thousands of years old. So it's pretty cool.
Those sound like some really special stones. How do they work?
Stones turning either the top or the bottom stone, turning at 100 to 125 revolutions per minute, produce a lovely 3-4 up to 500 pounds, depends on how soft the grain is. The bottom stone is the bedstone, and it's also called the nether stone in the Bible, but it also now turns for some configurations.
Would you say that using stone mills lead to healthier grains?
I know they do. I can watch it. I showed you. You know it as well as I do. The grain goes in the top, goes through the stones, and it comes out. We don't lose anything, and we don't add anything.
Thanks for sharing the story of how Bob's Red Mill is using ancient technology to keep their products on the cutting edge.
Michael, we think that we can make a difference by sticking by the traditional way of stone milling whole grain, and that's what we're doing.
You can learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today I'm speaking with Ben Lilliston from the Institute of Agriculture and Trade Policy, when we're talking about the current NAFTA renegotiation process. Okay, so before we went to break, you mentioned that consolidation, industry consolidation, is one of the big kind of, what has repercussions, basically, from this agreement. So what does this mean? I want to drill down on this a little bit more. What does this mean specifically for farmers, for U.S. farmers, and also for consumers?
Yeah, well, what NAFTA did, and then also the entry into the WTO, but also it's important to understand our Farm Bill, which is our main farm policy in the U.S., passed every 5 years. They all kind of work together to promote this idea of U.S. farmers entering into a global sort of food and farm system. So you're competing with other farmers in other countries. Prices are set globally, and you're dealing with agribusiness companies that are operating in multiple countries. So a lot of these big names, whether they're food companies or agribusiness, we sometimes think of them as U.S. companies, but they're really global, and they're thinking globally, and they're trying to figure out, where can I source whatever's being grown at the cheapest price? Where can I have as much as I want that I need, and where can I export it, move it around, or turn it into some other kinds of product, like if you're looking for corn and turning it into high fructose corn syrup or ethanol fuel or some kind of bioplastics or animal feed. So this is sort of the trend that NAFTA and the WTO and U.S. Farm Bill have accelerated. So the result has been that there are a lot of there have always been incentives for farmers to get bigger, to own bigger farms, because there are economies of scale associated with that. But this shift really turned that that trend and really sped it up. So what we have is fewer farmers on the land. I mean, NAFTA, you could see we lost 22% of our smaller scale farmers. So those are farmers with sort of $350,000 and less in net sales, to give you an idea what smaller farmers are.
Right.
But we also lost a lot of mid-sized farmers. Mm-hmm. So we lost somewhere around 6% of those. And a lot of then we see an increase in the number of large-scale farms. So what we have is fewer, bigger farms out there. And NAFTA really helped accelerate that process.
And I'm assuming these bigger farms are not necessarily producing, growing broccoli? Like, you know, are most of these... I don't know if this is, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like we export a whole lot of commodity crops and import a whole lot of vegetables. Is that fairly accurate?
That's right. That's right.
And
yeah,
so
most of the bigger farms are becoming more commodity crops. Like I said, that crops that can be used for a number of different things. And I'll just throw in real quickly, one of the big areas that you've seen fairly significant growth in since NAFTA and this kind of shift is in these large-scale animal operations or confined animal operations, where we are growing, particularly in the Midwest, where we're based in Minnesota, a lot of corn, a lot of soybeans that are used, at least a third of that is used as animal feed for these really huge operations that are raising pork and poultry and giant feedlots for cattle, and now we're seeing more and more of these really mega dairies, these huge dairy operations.
Are there the same issues with dairy in terms of, you know, animal welfare issues that in the dairy industry that we see in the, like, you know, beef for consumption? Like yeah. Are there CAFOs? So I always think of CAFOs for, like, you know, beef processing and not, I don't think of them for dairy, but are there similar issues in terms of the treatment of the cows?
Yes, there are similar issues, and it depends on what part of the country you are in, the way they have the mega dairies and the way they operate. You know, in California, in the San Joaquin Valley there, they have, you know, some of the largest dairies in the country. Those are open-air sort of giant feedlots. In the upper Midwest, they have Minnesota, Wisconsin, and so forth. They have more of the enclosed dairies where they spend a lot of their time inside. There are issues there around. There are animal welfare issues, but the bigger, or I'd say the issues that get more attention have to do are more environmentally focused issues around contamination of water from the giant amounts of waste that are produced in these confined operations, whether it's getting into waterways or contaminating drinking water, which is a big issue in parts of Wisconsin.
Hmm. So it's mostly
in California. It's a big issue around air quality. And the amount of methane and other pollutants that are emitted from these giant feedlots.
So it's more about, like, the number of animals within an area.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay, so what about for the consumer? Has this, you know, U.S. consumers, has this agreement really reduced prices? Like, and was that a big intention for when NAFTA was officially or first established?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's hard to say whether I'm not sure I can answer that question about whether prices have fallen. you do have more fruits and vegetables. I mean, one of the aspects of globalization is that it is easier to source fruits and vegetables year-round from other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
What we don't know as much, and we also, it's important to understand, too, is that when you bring in fruits and vegetables from other parts of the world, you're also potentially undercutting farmers in your community or your state who also want to grow those fruits and vegetables. They're competing against those kind of global systems. And even when I think a lot of us think of farmers markets or CSAs or buying locally from a farmer as operating into as a different system,
mm-hmm.
That they're not really competing, but at the end of the day, they really still feel the weight of those global imports and these giant companies bringing in, whether it's, you know, apples or avocados or tomatoes or other sorts of fruits and vegetables, bringing them into, when you can, you know, most of the supermarkets in the country can source from all over the world and get it, you know, immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what consumers have kind of gotten used to. But we still don't know, you know, it's a separation that we felt, I think, from our food and where it's grown and who's growing it.
Yeah. Yes. That is definitely a big separation. Okay. So, mm-hmm. So let's talk about like where we are right now. So why this agreement's being renegotiated. Why now? Like, has it changed at all over the past 23 years? Or
it has not. Yeah, it's a good question. It has not changed. You know, it's basically in place. The reason it's being renegotiated is that a lot of people aren't happy with NAFTA and feel like it was a bad trade deal. Most of that focus has come on in relation to workers and the movement of manufacturing plants and so forth. And Donald Trump made it a big issue in the campaign and said NAFTA was a terrible deal. I'm going to get in there. I'm going to renegotiate it. And he's followed through on that promise. I think his view about NAFTA is pretty narrow and often kind of off base. But
no.
He is opening up a discussion and debate about trade that we haven't had in this country for a while.
Okay.
And so that's what's happening right now. He's leading this push to renegotiate it, and what he wants to do is balance the trade. He feels like his definition of not having a trade agreement work is that we should be exporting more than we're importing, and so he wants to make some changes in NAFTA that allow him to do that.
Okay. What does everybody else think about that? I mean,
well, you know, it's going to be, if I think there's several things.
I mean, and by the way,
he's approaching it very similar to how he approaches a lot of things, which is basically, you know, kind of recklessly and often just kind of
uninformed.
A lot of threats are being levied against the other countries. But also it's just a very simplistic view of trade.
Mm-hmm.
From our perspective, we should be asking these kind of questions. We should be saying, how can we make sure that people living in all three countries are getting paid fairly? How can we make sure farmers in all three countries are succeeding and thriving? How can we make sure the environment is protected within this trade agreement? These are the kind of questions that should be the basis of revisiting NAFTA. And we do think we should be revisiting NAFTA. But he's not operating. He's sort of discarded those kinds of concerns and is really looking at mostly, you know, manufacturing goods and how do we ensure that we export more than the other countries involved. It's kind of a skewed and somewhat odd way to view a trade agreement. One of the things that I think people are concerned about is he's threatened to walk away from NAFTA and end the agreement
altogether.
There is some debate about whether he has the authority to do that. I think most people think he probably does. But that would be enormously disruptive to our food and agriculture system if you don't have another kind of idea in place about what you're going to put in place.
Yeah.
Like I said, most of the meat companies are sort of operating in all three countries. We're importing a lot of our fruit and vegetables. If you were to just sort of disrupt those supply chains, it could really affect farmers in all three countries. It could really affect workers and people who work in the food system in all three countries. And it could increase prices for consumers in our food system.
Right. I mean, so, you can't just undo 20 to 30 years of globalization, which he seems to think is possible. But I guess, like, I mean, is his sort of rudimentary desire, like, is there some kind of merit to, like, what he wants to do? Like, should that be the end goal? I mean, like, is that why we kind of would want to enter into a trade negotiation? Or is that, totally off, like, completely misses the mark? The desire to...
Well, I think it misses the mark. And if you're entering into a trade agreement or any kind of agreement, you want it to be a mutually beneficial agreement,
right,
that we all benefit from. It shouldn't be viewed as some kind of competition where I'm trying to screw you and get the better deal.
Yeah.
And you lose and I win. Because as we see in NAFTA, you know, and in the case of agriculture, the U.S. has done very well. If you were to just view it from Trump's view, we do export more, and we pushed a whole lot of Mexican farmers off the land in Mexico with our corn exports. Mexico and Canada are buying a lot of U.S. processed food. That could be viewed as a victory. But really, in many ways, it's created a system that, at the end of the day, I mean, I would argue for a lot of reasons we haven't won, whether it's the number of farmers on the land, whether it's the loss or difficulty and challenges of building local food systems and healthy food systems in all three countries. I think the idea that how do we negotiate a trade agreement where everyone... it's beneficial for everyone, and it's really looking at workers, farmers, the environment, health, as barometers for how we judge it. The main problem with NAFTA and all ensuing trade agreements is that they've really looked at these trade deals from the perspective of multinational corporations, and how do we, you know, make sure Cargill and Monsanto and Walmart benefit from this trade agreement, and then the benefits will just filter down to the rest of us. It's a very kind of trickle-down way of looking at it, and that hasn't worked.
Right. Yeah. I don't know why that still is talked about as, like, a potential solution so much, and even more broadly speaking in terms of, like, our tax policies in this country, but it's still something that we hear a lot about. So, I mean, I guess, does this issue fall along party lines? Does Trump represent Republicans who really would like to potentially walk away from this negotiation? Because it seems to me like there would be a lot of corporate interest and lobbying dollars spent to prevent this.
It does not fall on party lines. It's a pretty interesting issue. You're right. A lot of traditional Republican constituencies do not want to end NAFTA. And if you look back during the end of the Obama administration, he was pushing for something called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was basically an extension of NAFTA to include a lot of Asian countries, whether it's Japan, Vietnam, Australia, New Zealand, Malaysia. It was a kind of a big mega trade deal that followed along the lines of NAFTA. So there's some... It crosses both parties.
Right. Wasn't Bernie's camp was very much opposed to TPP?
That's right.
Yeah. And that that failed, obviously. So that is maybe a good... Ooh, is that like a kind of canary in the coal mine for what could be coming down the pike for NAFTA? Like, where is the sort of sentiment on this?
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of opposition to the TPP. And most of that was led by sort of progressive organizations, and that are traditionally associated with more Democratic Party kind of views, and so Bernie was giving voice to some of that. But I think that level of opposition to that agreement, even from a Democratic president, was showing that people were are not happy with this approach to trade. And so it opened the door for Trump to sort of step in and really kind of exploit that discontent. And Trump, when he came in, you know, pulled the U.S., ended U.S. involvement in the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and then now has started this renegotiation of NAFTA.
And by this approach, do you mean, what do you mean by that, this approach to trade that we have taken?
I think I was referring to this sort of free trade approach, this NAFTA approach, where you basically are trying to set a trade agreement on behalf of multinational corporations, and that the benefits will filter down, as opposed to starting with, you know, how do we make it work for people?
Okay, thank you. okay, so is there any like upside if we would kind of end this? Well, first of all, what is the likelihood, you know, if you could kind of like look at your crystal ball and see like what is the likelihood of this, you know, not being renegotiated and us just sort of pulling out of the agreement? And would there be any winners in that situation, like specifically small family vegetable farmers? Like, would that ultimately be a good thing for them?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think the likelihood, it's hard, very difficult to predict. They're in the middle of the negotiations. They've hit a really rough spot right now where there seem to be very wide divisions, and people are openly talking about the possibility that the Trump administration will walk away and they'll end NAFTA. I think it's sort of a 50-50 question. Normally trade agreements can take multiple years to finish because they're very complex, and you know, you get a lot of lawyers sitting around a table, and it can take a long time. The Trump administration really wanted to get this done quickly, so one scenario would be they reflect on that and decide, okay, we're going to go a little more slowly and take our time to negotiate this, and that would drag this out for a while, and then we could see where it goes. Or they may get frustrated and just say, that's it, we're walking away. Like I said, right now I think people feel like it's a 50-50 chance that could happen.
Wow. That seems way more than
I think it wouldn't be. It probably would be a good thing if we ended NAFTA and really rethought our trade policy. In the short run, it was, as I mentioned, cause a lot of disruption, and many people would probably feel some of the pain. What we need to do is not just think about our trade policy, but we have to think about our domestic farm policy together, because our farm bill is really about promoting more and more commodity crop production, which feeds into global markets, feeds into a lot of animal and meat production, feeds into ethanol, feeds into these other systems. And we don't provide much support relatively to, you know, the small-scale fruit and vegetable farmers. Mm-hmm. There are programs within the Farm Bill that do support them, but it's not really there. They don't have the same kind of risk mitigation programs that the other parts of the Farm Bill have. They don't have access to markets. They don't have the infrastructure that we need to have in place for those local food systems to thrive, nor the credit systems that they need to thrive. So there's a lot that we could do in a Farm Bill if we said, we want to really rebuild these local food systems and make them stronger and reconnect people with farmers and food. But that would require a whole different farm bill. And that's where you see these things intertwine: the farm bill, our local food system, our global food system, and trade agreements. That if we're going to take a different approach on trade, then we need to also take a different approach in our farm bill.
So all roads lead to the farm bill, it sounds like. And now is a good time to get involved. So what, you know, with the kind of new version coming out, right, within this next year?
Yeah, they're negotiating right now. They're talking about writing parts of a new farm bill right now.
So where is a good place? So if you're a consumer who cares about these issues, where would you recommend people first kind of get involved? And then, and then where would that be? I mean, is that lobbying specific elected officials? What can people kind of do right now to maybe set effect change?
Well, I think the first thing would be to get in touch with your elected representatives. There are a number of groups that are putting forth different kinds of proposals around the Farm Bill. So we are also part of the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition, our organization. And they have basically put together a model Farm Bill that is along the lines that I was describing, that is more focused on local food production as well as healthier food and more environmentally sustainable food. So that would be a good place to start to kind of get some ideas about what you want to talk to your member of Congress about and basically say, we want a different approach on the Farm Bill, and this is what we care about. And then I think the other part is then looking at NAFTA and engaging on trade. Trade is very difficult for a lot of people. Feel like it's complicated. It's something I don't understand. I can't really touch it. I don't really know how to engage on it. And that's intentionally so. I think they want to keep people away from trade rules, even though they're really important and affect a lot of parts of our life. So this is another opportunity, I think, to get in touch with your member of Congress and really demand that they get involved in these NAFTA negotiations. Congress is taking kind of a step back, and they're letting President Trump largely negotiate this trade deal. They don't have to do that. They can get much more involved. They can demand to see the negotiating text. They can say, these are issues we really care about, and they can play a more deliberate and very involved role in these NAFTA negotiations.
Yes, Congress could be doing a lot more, period. Full stop, but also on this issue. All right, well, we're going to have to leave it there today. Ben, thank you so much for joining me on the show and unpacking some of these really, really interesting issues.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
All right. Okay, and for more information, if you want to read more, go to iatp.org to check out some of the fabulous resources that Ben's organization makes available. I want to give a big thanks to our sponsors, as always, for their generous support. And a thanks to our fabulous show intern, Hannah Weiss, as well as our engineer, Feeder Hirscht. Show music is by Tim Archer, and all episodes of Eating Matters are available on the Heritage Radio Network website or as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe. I'm Jenna Lee Ute, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaili, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.